Aalto University Podcast.
This is Cloud Reachers. I'm Tomi Kauppinen. Today, it's my big honor to welcome Gottfried Zimmermann from Stuttgart Media University.
Hello, thank you for inviting me, Tomi.
This is great. I mean, we have been planning this for, 6 months or so when I visited Stuttgart.
Yes.
Right, yeah. So we finally are there. Let's start. I mean, you have been very actively studying digital accessibility and you have run so many research projects. You have also developed the first European MOOC on digital accessibility. So can you share more insight about those activities?
Well, first, accessibility, the community is, it's like a family, actually. So I was at a conference 2 weeks ago in Bologna, Italy, and saw all the people, some of them that I know, some that I don't know yet. And it's really nice to be there. It's a small community, but it's a growing community. And so if you were involved in some projects, you know the people and they know the others, and then you're part of the family, basically. I've participated in like 5-6 bigger research projects. And if I look back, I have to say it's not an easy job, digital accessibility. There is not so much awareness out there. Of course, like for the physical accessibility, you see you need ramps for people with wheelchairs and so, but not so much for digital. What are the barriers for digital? And we developed a lot of prototypes, ideas, concepts. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, as far as I know, none of them made it into real products that you can buy. And that's kind of disappointing because every time you start a project, you think, okay, that's it. And there's still some potential in some of the ideas about personalization, about evolving the idea of assistive technologies as personal preferences and rolling it out to the general as a mainstream idea of personalization, individualization. There were standards that we produced on the international arena, but companies have such a hard time, the bigger ones, such a hard time to adopt this without pressure. Having said that, my project on the MOOC, which you just mentioned, so the first European MOOC, that was really successful from the perspective of the impact. So we saw that there were on our like four MOOCs that we produced, there were like 20,000 participants altogether who registered. Doesn't mean that all 20,000 went through the whole courses, but we had at least 20,000 registered people altogether all over the world.
That is impact. I mean,
as far as India, Australia, Africa, countries where people can speak English and understand English. That was really amazing. That was really great to see. And also the cooperation here in Europe with European projects was great. It was a project funded by Erasmus, by the European Union.
When I'm hearing that, is it so that, you mentioned that there is no one single like business deal, which is kind of amazing around these ideas, or product, like you mentioned, but is it that the impact comes slower than perhaps anticipated, so, and through these MOOCs and kind of...
Yeah, I think as a researcher, you have to be kind of sober, not expect too much. Mm. I think that some of the concepts have made it into products like personalization, Microsoft, Apple, they all have these personalization settings and so on. So there's kind of the ideas. But I'm thinking about one project. It was one of my first research projects. I was a technical coordinator, and it was about smart home devices. And we wanted to make white goods. So in the house, you have like dishwasher, washing machine. So these are the so-called white goods. I wanted to make them accessible to people with disabilities. And we had a bigger company that was participating and was disappointing that in the end, they did not adopt these concepts that we developed and the prototypes that we developed. Instead, what they did, they were actually discontinuing this this product that was actually able to be remotely controlled and that was the chance to make it accessible. There was some marketing decision that we didn't understand. Our partners in that company didn't understand it either, but that came from the top.
Well, I mean, that is certainly a challenge, but I mean, still you are very focused and you drive this active. So what drives you yourself, I mean, to do all these activities in, I mean, terms of learning or creating new digital accessibility models? And
there is, I have a personal interest in this area, obviously, and it fascinates me. When I look back, it started after school, after high school. I was actually at a Christian mission and printing Arabic Braille Bibles. You know, if you, that was in Germany. All up to today, if you have Braille products, books and so, you can ship them worldwide without any postage, because it's actually free. It's a privilege. And so we printed like these big books of Bibles. One of them is like the New Testament alone, over 20 books, and it's like a meter long if you arrange them on the shelf. And I wrote a program. I had some computing and programming abilities acquired at school and so, but I always thought, oh, computer science is something for like military rockets and so at that time, or just playing video games or so. I didn't really see much sense. And when I made this Braille printing program to print the Bible in Braille, I thought, well, it makes sense to do something good with computer science. So that was the beginning of kind of that. I learned, got to know people who are blind or with other disabilities, and that was really interesting. And I guess everybody who has some contact with people with disabilities and make friends with them, then you suddenly feel like, oh, this is really an interesting area. If you're also into science and computer science. So I studied computer science. I think it's, and I realized it's good that even if you think there are risks of some technology, you know, it's always ambivalent. You can always do something for the good or for the bad. But you shouldn't leave the development of these technologies to those who are not aware of the risks, because those who are aware can really help to steer it into a good direction. So I thought, well, this is great. Computer science can help people with disabilities and everybody, of course. I studied in Stuttgart. We had like courses of software engineering, also human-computer interaction. I did them all. And at the end, I found out HCI, human-computer interaction, is probably the most interesting, because it's not predictable if you work with humans. So if you have a software program, even if it fails, it's predictable, but not with humans. So usability and accessibility is really great. And if you do usability really in its full range, then you need to accommodate the needs of people who are on the edges as well. And that makes it really interesting. So I always tell my students, we're doing this about digital accessibility is part of my lecture. We're doing this for your own sake, because it really helps you to understand the full width of usability, not just like the medium the average. And it helps you to be creative. And it's also for our own sake, because at some point we get older and we might need that as well. So
yeah, that's true. And isn't it also that we need it in different contexts? I don't know if I ever mentioned, but my mother used to work for the Library of Blind for the whole of her career. So I visited there quite often, mm-hmm. and I even worked there myself for 2 months when I was like 20 years old, when I started, when I was the first year computer science student. So I was, I mean, I so connect to you with LD. I mean, how fascinating it was to try to understand, okay, what does it actually mean to make use of computers for those that cannot, for example, in this case, read. Mm-hmm. I was listening to a lot of audiobooks in that summer, because I mean, I was, you know, organizing different audiobooks. So my hands were tied with the organization, but my ears and mind was free, right? So I could listen. And perhaps those experiences actually led me to start, for example, this podcast series, who knows? So what do you think about it? Like, I mean, all people have anyways different contexts. I mean, we are perhaps commuting, so we, I mean, we cannot look at anything visual, right? So we have to use just our ears if we want to connect with something interesting. So what do you think about this?
There's always kind of a situation that is perfect for one channel or yeah. modality.
Yeah.
Like what you mentioned, driving, it's perfect for listening, audio. It doesn't fit to all situations, but it's good. We've seen that a lot, that technologies that were developed for people with disabilities in the first hand become mainstream and can be used by everybody, yeah. like a speech recognition or so. Mm-hmm. And then people suddenly realize, oh, that's something I could use too.
Yeah. For example, I read news that the Library of Blind is nowadays a bit struggling with a lot of needs from, you know, regular people to borrow audiobooks. Mm-hmm. And they are thinking like, okay, what they should do. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, it's all about accessibility for all, basically, like Laura Kalbach's book is saying.
I think they should lend it to everybody. Yeah. I mean, it's great to see
that. Yeah, I so agree. And I really agree. I mean, like what you said, that we, all of us, anyways, we will be old at some point if we leave that far away. So,
yeah. So this is actually called the e-curb cuts. I don't know if you know that expression.
I don't know. No,
curb cuts are in American English are like the on the sidewalks, the borders that are cut so that you can push wheelchairs over it.
Yeah.
Electronic curb cut. So the curb cut is a symbol for something that was made for people with disabilities, but now used by everybody, strollers, bikes, and shopping carts. Yeah. And so in the electronic area, we have lots of things there too, like subtitles or captions that are used not only by people who are deaf.
No, absolutely not. Yeah, they're super useful. I mean, also to learn languages. I mean, when we talk about learning, I mean, how do you learn a new language? Subtitles help a lot.
It's great, Or for people, for children, if you have like subtitles that go word by word while you speak, then you can even learn exactly the word, how it looks like while it's spoken. Yeah,
exactly. Or karaoke.
Yeah, that's karaoke. And it's the same that people with dyslexia like to have.
Yeah, amazing. If you look at look at the situation, our era. I mean, it's so much online information, so many online platforms, AI. So what do you think? Like, is it that we are driving those platforms or they are driving us? Or, I mean, what should we learn, I mean, as humans in this era? I mean, should we just trust all those recommendations made by those platforms, what we should look next or listen next, or should we sometimes think ourselves, and how do we even learn to think critically in this case, I suppose, or, you know, I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, it's really sometimes overwhelming, and I don't claim I know this area very well. I think you always need to focus. You need to find your spot where you focus on. You need to focus on things that you're interested in and where you want to have an influence, where you want to have an impact. For me, it's the aspect of accessibility. Mm. And for others, it may be the aspect of how do you learn most efficiently or so. So none of us can really cover the full width of this. And I think it's also important to keep your feet on the ground, to keep in touch with people who really implement this. Sometimes maybe even we implement something, but I used to program a lot, but I don't have time to it anymore, so that's a pity. But then I still need to stay grounded to the people who do this, like my staff, my students, projects, and so. Yeah, it's really a challenge because it's overwhelming, and also you need to keep your life balance some way. I mean, I have a wife, I have a daughter, and I have family. I go to church, I have fellow believers in Jesus, and that's how I keep my balance. I mean, that's in my personal life. If you focus on one thing only in your, like on the work in your life, I'm not sure you keep the balance there.
Yeah, I so agree. Like actually look around and this whole world and try to have some more values than just the what is perhaps fed you through the screen.
Exactly. And and then sometimes there are connections between like what you would call your private life and your professional life, and you get to know in your private life, you get to know people who are interested in this or who have a disability, and then you can connect this, and I think that really makes it more authentic, rather than just seeing this as your professional and that's it. I mean, I like the professional challenge of this, but I also like to really get in touch with people and on a personal basis.
Yeah, it's the people who drive this world. I mean, that's why also in Aalto Online Learning we have been creating a community rather than focusing, I mean, first in the technology and also creating online learning ourselves, not just believing what is perhaps in all those video sharing platforms and sharing those directly to our students, but at least, you know, facilitate learning and also create contents ourselves. So of course, that comes with a great responsibility as well, right?
And there is sometimes in our universities, there is a wrong incentive to write papers.
Yeah,
and as if papers were the only thing to prove you're an expert or you're good, because if you want to write a good paper, that really takes time, and you need to prepare that, and you need to be in contact with those that really know how this field can live and how this field works, and not just from like an oversight at 10,000 feet view.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I mean, university has these three kind of tasks or responsibilities. I mean, of course, research, academic work, but then also teaching, helping people to actually learn, and then this societal impact, right? And I so agree. I mean, it's kind of clear that sometimes, I mean, not even sometimes, but quite often people focus only on research, for example. Sometimes perhaps only on teaching, I don't know. But really rarely somebody is focusing only on societal impact. So I so agree with you. I mean, of course it means dividing our time to all between all these three tasks. I mean, running this podcast, this is about, I don't know, societal impact, about learning. I would say it's also research, exactly, because we are talking about research. Was it last Friday I submitted one paper to a conference, and you know, it's you know, we have to do all of these together,
right?
Otherwise, you know, it's very limited. I so agree with you. Hey, I wanted to ask you about because when I visited Stuttgart Media University in January, right? It was really, really fascinating. I mean, it's quite a few different media kind of fields that you are covering. I mean, you have students that become film directors, and then you have students that become web developers, and that's quite a range, right?
Mm-hmm. And nowadays we have a lot of about immersive technologies, virtual reality, augmented reality, which is a challenge for accessibility, actually.
And
that's one of the research fields that I'm looking to really deal with in the future.
Mm-hmm. Have you have already some insight about what you can learn in virtual reality or?
So basically we have for, and I'm coming from the perspective of accessibility.
Yeah.
So there are two things. First of all, we need to make learning environments accessible to all students. Yeah. So that means also VR, AR. Yeah. And it's not clear yet how you make these things accessible. So like on the web, there is this set of guidelines. People know that web content accessibility guidelines. And one of the guidelines is that you need to make everything accessible from the keyboard. So that because the keyboard is kind of the common denominator for everybody who cannot use the mouse to provide input. Now, in VR, you don't have a keyboard.
No,
So how do you do this? So the whole thing about input to the environment is not clear. I mean, it's obvious that like VR for a blind person is difficult.
Yeah.
That's obvious, but there are some other things that are not so obvious that need to be solved. That's one thing. And I've actually applied for a project where we want to look into this and basically take the web content accessibility guidelines and apply them to VR, AR, immersive technologies.
That's really interesting because, I mean, if you look at augmented reality, one input criteria is or one type of input is the location, right?
Yes.
So you enter a certain location. Mm-hmm. So it's actually about physical accessibility suddenly at the same time.
Yeah.
Because if you cannot access that location well, then you are not accessing that information.
That's one input mode, but you can also, I mean, there are different modes like these jumping to a position so.
That's true.
But interestingly, in VR, not so much AR, but virtual reality, we have another, I call it disability in quotes, that's motion sickness or cyber sickness.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's, I think it's really in the same range. And I myself am affected by that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like this is something that we need to pay attention to. And it's a mainstream thing. So if I let my students try these things out, then some of them say, yeah, I really got dizzy.
Oh, that's interesting because I mean, you know, it's a lot of news now that many of our jobs will be reformed and some of the jobs will be done in virtual reality in the future, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there are these famous examples about architects working in virtual reality to build houses for us. What if somebody has this kind of surprising disability of motion sickness, right? So does it prevent doing this work in the future?
There are studies. Developers have found out how they can prevent it to a certain degree, like narrowing the field of view, or then this teleporting. So you can actually provide different modes of transportation, basically.
Okay.
Or you blur things. So there are different techniques. Especially it amounts to, well, in general, it amounts to don't show animations. Because animations cause this dizziness. So if you jump to a position, or if you blur animations, or if you make the field of view smaller, then that can help. Yeah. There's another thing that I wanted to say about this. AR, VR is also has a high potential of building awareness for barriers that people with disabilities have. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we call that simulation, but it's not the right word. It's really empathy, awareness building.
Yeah.
Because you never know. I mean, if I walk around for 5 minutes with a blindfolded eyes, then I cannot claim I know how it is to be blind. That doesn't work. But it is a way to become aware of the barriers that exist if you cannot use some of your senses.
And that's super interesting. When I was in Bremen a few years ago, in 6 months, I had a student group focusing in their student work exactly on this. So on different simulations, like let's simulate you are like 80 years old, right? So 90 years old. And I mean, they had fantastic examples of costumes, for example, that you wear. So suddenly you cannot move that fast anymore and stairs are like, no way.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot see anything and you cannot hear anything, I mean, almost anything. And it was super interesting. It I mean, and when you mention now virtual reality, that would be really, really interesting. So really, I mean, helping people to feel empathy and understanding that, okay, well, I mean.
Yeah, if you're a young designer, I think you tend to think just about humans as yourself. We see that awareness building also in companies, in organizations where you want to change something, where you want to make products and environments more accessible.
Yeah.
The first step is awareness building. So that the designer, when they think about designing something, they have in mind the range of capabilities and their users and the variety of users that exist. And that's really helpful. This aging suit is helpful. Or what we sometimes do is, for example, let people watch a video without sound and then with subtitles only, so they see the difference. If you cannot hear, and then suddenly you hear, or just the audio of a video, and then later with audio description, so that they can then follow what's going on without seeing the screen, but they can follow by the audio what's going on. And so being aware of first the barriers, but also the assistive technologies, the adaptations, the possibilities that exist to overcome these barriers.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about EU use directives? I mean, there is now guidelines for these accessibility statements, and I mean, actually requirements for accessibility statements, and of course to do something about accessibility of all websites by public organizations. So is this, I mean, obviously this is a good step, but do you believe that this will have a wide effect, or what is your take on that?
It does have an effect already. I see that. Actually, yesterday was one of the target dates, September 23rd, where you have to have all websites accessible now. I've waited for this 16 years.
Okay.
So I used to be a consultant, freelancer, before I was a professor, and was trying to convince companies to make their things accessible. But there was no drive, there was no demand.
Okay, I see.
And I can see that that this regulatory, the pressure, that really changes things.
Yeah.
I won't say that people don't want to have their products accessible, but there's always so much with higher priority. So that accessibility lays on the bottom of the stack or in the middle, and only the top will get dealt with. And so we need this pressure. It's unfortunately, there are so many reasons to make your things accessible, and they're all very nice and convincing, but they, with our business models, they're not strong enough. So we really need this legislation, and it already works. Actually, I see there is a demand now. I was at the German conference on usability, mentioned computer in Hamburg, we really see that the demand is almost exploding now among companies.
Okay, I see.
And this is due to this, what you just mentioned, the Web Accessibility Directive, which is now becoming active. It was actually issued in December 2016.
Yeah.
But most recently, in June of this year, 2019, the European Union issued what they call European Accessibility Act. And that has even more impact, because now companies are required to make their products and services accessible. Yeah. It affects banks, so online banking, it affects ticket machines, it affects computers, ebooks, mobile phones, and apps in these areas. Online shopping, the whole area of online shopping will become accessible 6 years from now. It's a long time, but it is something that is fixed, and that's important, so people can deal with it. And if you start a new project now, you better think of accessibility, because there are long development cycles.
Yeah, that's true. And what I found already now is that there are super good instructions, like how to make your website accessible, and it's perhaps this is what companies and organizations have been waiting for, right? So that there is some rather clear set of instructions, like what to do, while previously it was perhaps so many different opinions and kind of harder to grasp, especially with the priority lists. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And there is a chance of online learning here. So if you look into the English speaking area in the US, there are really good online courses. Some of them you have to pay for, but a moderate amount of money, not so expensive. Mm. And some are free. Mm. But what's missing, what I see in Germany, is German speaking information that's missing.
Okay.
Because
yeah.
my students can, of course, go to an English online course, that's okay. But there are lots of professionals that have worked in their profession for a long
yeah.
time,
yeah.
and they don't feel comfortable learning in English. And maybe they do, but then they're not comfortable taking exams in English, because
yeah.
what we want to work for is really a certification for digital
yeah.
accessibility experts
yeah.
and professionals.
Yeah, that prevents them from having perhaps turning points in their career or life that they would deserve or need. How about yourself? Like, do you remember, like, what is the turning point in your learning, or can be anything? I mean, of course, about research, something that made you think differently.
There were several, I think. So my career was kind of divided in phases.
Yeah.
Like, there was the phase when I studied, and then when I did my PhD and worked at a big software company at the same time.
Whoa.
And they developed software as
yeah.
a freelancer, and they didn't have accessibility on their minds at all.
Yeah.
And I, at the same time, I was working on a PhD thesis on making visual diagrams and so accessible to people who are blind or can hardly
yeah.
see. The turning point was kind of, okay, I have to make a decision. Do I want to go further in the accessibility or in like mainstream? I had a good job there actually in the end, but I went to the US as a postdoc to the Trace Center, to Greg Van der Heijden, who is one of the first authors of the web accessibility guidelines.
Yeah.
That was a turning point as well, to see, oh, accessibility is not just about visually impaired people.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I knew that, but
yeah.
I always dealt with visually impaired people in my PhD
yeah,
thesis.
Yeah.
And so I really got a much broader perspective.
Yeah.
Then I went back and wanted to start a business on this, and I survived because I did research. But
yeah.
it was not my original idea of consulting industry
okay,
that
I
could
see.
Do. That was kind of a turning point. Then I became professor. There was a chance to become a professor in Tübingen. As a junior professor, later professor at Stuttgart Media University, which is really a great environment to work
mm.
there. And last turning point was kind of about learning. So we have this certificate for didactics, and it's a voluntary thing that you can do, and it takes several semesters. And I appreciate the insights that I got from other disciplines, not just
oh, yeah,
computer
yeah,
science,
yeah, yeah.
social sciences, and so on. We're all together in a group and doing things. And then as part of the certificate, I did a project on flipped classroom learning.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was really influential for me. And I discovered this, and I had a good mentor, and she helped me to design this in a good way. And I applied it to my classes, and yeah. Yeah, you really need these turning points from time to time.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you call them turning point or something that really made you think again about
yeah.
something or so. Yeah, that's very important.
What do you think? What is the ideal phase ideal length for one phase? Is it 5 years? I mean, I always say that it's 5 years that I have to choose.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I had like sometimes 3 years,
okay.
sometimes five.
Yeah.
Right now, I have been in Stuttgart for almost 8 years. Yeah, I'm in the eighth year now.
Yeah.
I feel like there's something new that should happen now. And I'm starting this competence center on digital accessibility.
Okay, great.
Which is a very small beginning,
yeah,
a small
yeah.
budget and so, but I really hope this will become also a turning point for me
yeah.
because I want to get my feet wet again
and
have an impact on my own university because
yeah.
I preach basically to others how to do accessibility, and then in my own university, I see that it's not working, which is kind of embarrassing. And so I need to work on that.
Very nice. Hey, how about online learning? What did you learn online last time?
So I kind of from time to time watch webinars. Which is kind of like a small nugget of online learning. A month ago, I watched one that was, it was actually kind of a mix of research and marketing webinar. And I got introduced to tools that are existing to make automatic tests on whole websites and to monitor this and so on. So that was good. And I was thinking about testing them with a student project and then maybe adopting one for our own university. Online learning, like in a real longer perspective, that was a year ago when I was at Georgia Tech on my sabbatical. And that was one of the purposes, the main purpose of my sabbatical, to look at the different online classes and online material that exist on digital accessibility. So you mentioned that in the beginning, I was coordinating the project that made the first European MOOC on this topic. And almost at the same time in the US, there was a MOOC developed and then ran by Georgia Tech, the AMAC Center, Accessibility Center of Georgia Tech. And I spent my sabbatical there and said, okay, might be good to connect and get connected. And that was really good. I looked at online sources, courses, also commercial online courses, which exist in the US and which is great. I really welcome that companies invest in this. It's a good sign. And I did two certificates then in the end. So, I mean, I'm an expert in this area, but I still learned things, which is great. And I especially learned how it is to learn online and then to do an online exam. Your supervised exam, you're monitored, you sit in, and it's a multiple choice test. And it's not so easy as you think in the first place.
Yeah, sometimes it's good to be a learner. Why not even every day or at least every year, I mean, in many, many cases. Talk about learning, I mean, talk about future. So how do you see future of learning? What is your vision about future of learning? Obviously, including online learning and everything, I mean, all the different forms of learning that we might think of.
Well, I think there will always be a need for physical presence, because we're humans, we're social beings.
Yeah, I mean, we are in a physical space now.
That's, but it can be really, I think, nicely blended. And I feel like this presentation style, one-way style, lecture style, I don't like it. My students don't like it. So flipped classroom is something that I really like. But there are also problems. So sometimes what I see is that if you say, okay, watch this video, and I record my sessions, my lectures, and then say to my students, watch this, and then we come together, discuss, and we do the assignment together, or talk about the assignments. And then usually many of them skip the step of watching the video and just go right to the assignment or discussion. And that hampers discussion because you need to catch up with them, and then the session is over, and you don't have really the fruitful discussion that you wanted to have. So it's not always ideal. But if you have motivated students, sometimes you need to pressure them a bit with, okay, if you contribute to discussion online in a forum or so, then that's a requirement to actually get entrance to the exam or things like that. So unfortunately, sometimes we need to pressure people. But a mixture of online learning, where everybody can have their own pace of learning and coming together, discussion, doing work together, projects together. I think that's the future, but it's not like the one thing that needs to be done.
Perhaps it requires different kind of learning designs, like, I don't know, I mean, somehow creating the motivation to watch the video. I don't know, there is some different models that I've been testing myself, and like really trying to increased in motivation, like for students to want to understand how something works, and then only then give the video,
right.
Only then give the article when they are really, really hungry for information.
Well, what I see sometimes is the expectation of students is that, okay, I don't need to learn because memorizing things, that's old fashioned. And the expectation is, okay, I can do everything by hands on.
Yeah.
And that's not true. Sometimes you really need to learn first, hard learning, memorizing things to get the connection, to get the associations, and to have your basically build up your learning space where you can then do your hands-on work and so on.
That's true.
That's something that we all need to learn how to learn, and that changes with different technologies. But in essence, it's always the same. You need to be invested in something. And I'm, as a learner, I'm responsible for learning, not my lecturer or my mentor.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Hey, find a question. And we are asking this from all our guests. So first of all, big thanks for joining, Gottfried. This has been a big pleasure. And our podcast is called Cloud Reachers, which means many things like reaching out clouds or dreams or online, if you like. So if you think about a cloud reacher in your field, who or what could that be?
Sometimes it's the people who don't reach that far are the cloud reachers, people who are interested in other people with disabilities, who are friends with them, who help them and also get helped by them. So that's kind of stay connected, stay on the ground. On the other hand, we need people who develop technology so that people with disabilities can become independent, not relying on the help of other humans, because that can be, it's kind of your dignity that you are independent and you only need or have help when you want it, and you're not necessarily relying on the help of others. So that's important. And if you can combine the two, I think that's really what's means to be reaching clouds. My former boss and mentor, Greg van der Heijden, is really such a person who has done great research, but always in a practical way and always in mind, how can you apply it in the end? So that research really gets to the people and is not just something that can be written up in papers.
Great. Hey, thanks so much for joining. So this is Cloud Reachers and Tomi Kauppinen. See you next time, or listen to you next time, hear you next time. Ciao.